With Ross Reynolds, I'm Marcy Silman. What does it mean to take care of a loved one with dementia? How do you cope with the incremental changes that pile up and change that relationship you once had? And how do you take care of yourself in the process? That's something journalist Nell Lake chronicles in her new book, The Caregivers. Nell spent a full year with a caregiver support group. It's a group she met by chance.
I went in late 2009 to a birthday party for a friend at a restaurant. And just happened to sit next to a man who, in the book, I call Ben. I should just say that I changed people's names and a few place names. Those are the only details that I changed. Everything else is entirely nonfiction. I met Ben, and we got to talking. He said he was the lead behavioral health counselor on the behavioral health unit at our local hospital. And also that he facilitated a support group for caregivers. And I told him I was a writer interested in health, healthcare, mental health. And he thought I would be interested in sitting in on this group. He said both they're interesting people. They have really difficult challenges. And also they kind of realize that they're part of a larger struggle that so many people are going through.
They were all pretty much involved in some way with either spouses or parents. These were all familial relationships, right?
Absolutely, yeah, informal caregivers.
And were all of the people being cared for suffering from the same sorts of illnesses or ailments?
No. All of them had what you could call long-term chronic illnesses, degenerative for some reason or the other illnesses. Many of them did have dementia, which, of course, is one of the most challenging conditions to cope with when you're a caregiver.
But the dementia presented itself, it seemed like, in the people that you wrote of, very differently from person to person. And the relationship between the intimate caregiver and that person for whom they were caring was really different. Some of it dependent upon how things manifested themselves.
Absolutely. So the relationships varied a lot. They were all either spouses or parents. But one of the things that I learned so much about is how previous relationships will inform your experience of caregiving.
How so? You mean like in the past, not
yes.
That initial relationship?
No, the relationship you had with the person previously. So that, you know, your memories of the person, the way the relationship was previously, really affected the emotional response that you have, the psychological response. So, for instance, one woman whom I call Liz, her husband had been verbally abusive toward her for many years, even before his diagnosis of Alzheimer's, so that she was in a real kind of conundrum about how to respond. She felt a responsibility, but also it was very difficult for her, as opposed to someone who had been very close, say, to their mother, and it was a much more positive experience to respond to mother's needs.
But still difficult.
No question, still difficult.
I'm speaking with Nell Lake. Her book is called The Caregivers, a support group's stories of slow loss, courage, and love. It got me to wondering, reading this book, people had expectations of themselves in the caregiver role, but what kinds of externals, what does society expect of people when their husband, their wife, their parent becomes ill?
Well, the first thing I think of is how it varies by gender. I think that is still true, even though more and more men are stepping into the caregiving role. I believe it's about 2/3 of caregivers are now women. So that means 1/3 are men, which is much higher than it used to be. But I think still the ways that men and women respond are different. And that is in part because of historically the way we've been expected to respond. So women are responding more in the sort of very intimate sort of physical kind of tasks that are required. Men tend to more take care of logistics perhaps or kind of problem solve. That's sort of the stereotype. And it actually was pretty borne out by what I saw.
The other thing that it seemed that everybody shared, no matter what approach they took, was an exhaustion, a sort of psychic exhaustion, a physical exhaustion, but more than that.
Yeah, that's particularly true with dementia, I think. And that's because of something that I write about called, well, I call it slow loss, but a psychologist named Pauline Boss, she calls it coined it back in the 70s, ambiguous loss. It's loss that is ongoing and unclear. So someone is disappearing in a sense. They're changing into in ways that you never would have expected given who they were before. And yet they're still around. So you have to continually adjust seeing someone who you love or perhaps even don't love, as was the case in at least one person in my book. But anyway, change, and you have to adjust to that. And it is psychically exhausting.
You mentioned Penny and her mom, and one of the central struggles that Penny has, although they seem like they had, at least around you, a pretty cheery relationship compared to some of the people. But it was, at what point is it impossible to be a caregiver in and to share a home anymore? In other words, at some point, most of these people faced, can I do this in my house, or do I have to look at institutions or some other kind of living situation?
Right.
And it seemed like that, for everybody in the book, was a great source of fear and guilt.
Mm-hmm. That was really, I would say, Penny's central conflict was, how much longer can I do this? And what happens when I, how am I going to decide that? And what happens when I decide I can't do this any longer? And I think, well, for her, the decision ended up getting made in almost an intuitive way. She just knew, okay, it's time. But I think what I noticed with people was either there's a safety issue. You just simply can't keep a person who is wandering or who might leave a stove on and, you know, that's a fire risk, or fall and not be able to get help. That kind of safety issue, I think sometimes it comes down to that. And I truly think sometimes it just comes down to, is the cost to me greater than the benefit to anybody, if you see what I mean?
But I think I was wondering, because it seems like some people can't come to that decision to put themselves first for whatever reason. I mean, maybe it's that it's their true love, and mm-hmm. and it's just too heartbreaking to do that, or that there is a lot of guilt involved in making that decision, because sometimes the person you're caring for is with it enough to be really, really angry about that decision.
Yeah. Well, that's where the support group was so valuable to the members. And always in an evolving way, they could consider those questions, talk about guilt, see that other people were going through the same issues, and perhaps, you know, getting the support so that they didn't need to move the person they were caring for into a facility as soon. You know, sometimes the guilt is, in fact, guilt because you feel so exhausted and so angry. And if you can deal with those things, then everything becomes more workable.
You started this book with a story about your own grandmother. You didn't serve as her caregiver. I don't think you've served as a caregiver for anybody who's in this particular position. What's the connection between that story and these people's stories?
The connection between my grandmother's stories and these people's stories is that she chose very dramatically to avoid the whole stage of life that I was witnessing via the caregivers, of course. So she found out that she might have cancer when she was 78 years old. And she'd always been very independent and strong-willed in a kind of graceful way. Mm. But she had kept materials about from the Hemlock Society in her kitchen drawer. And so she found out she might have cancer when she was 78, as I said. And that very night, she went to her garage, sat in the car, and turned it on, and committed suicide. And so it struck me it wasn't a direct line between knowing my grandmother's story and deciding to write about this book, but very early on in sitting with these people, I thought, this is what none of us ever did for my grandmother, and that she avoided altogether.
Are you still in touch with any of these people?
Very much so. Yeah, they virtually all of, well, the main, quote, characters in the book came to the book launch, to the reading, and we had a wonderful time. They became part of the conversation afterwards, and I'm still in touch with them, and there have been some deaths, so I've been, you know, aware of that and responding to those, too.
Well, so just thinking about your grandmother and your mother, who lives close to the community where you and your husband and family live, I know you spoke with her in the course of writing this. She's in this book as well. What do you personally carry away from what it means to be a caregiver, looking at aging parents? You're that proverbial sandwich person because you've got school-age kids and parents that are, if not infirm, older.
Mm-hmm. So far, my mother is fine. But
good.
But certainly looking ahead to that. And I think, as I say in the book, one thing I learned is just the importance of conversation and looking ahead and kind of openness that my grandmother was not open to. She was not open to being vulnerable and certainly not to being dependent. And so just talking about that issue even, and Mom, what do you want? And thinking about what I want for myself and communicating with my sister, who also lives near my mother, and, you know, thinking about ways that we'll meet her needs when the time comes.
Nell Lake's book is The Caregiver. She's going to be speaking tonight at 7:30 at Elliott Bay Books on Seattle's Capitol Hill. With Ross Reynolds, I'm Marcy Silman. More of The Record ahead here on KUOW.